Except they said, no, multiple personalities, there isn't a healthy version.
What?
And I thought, wait. Maybe there is.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Jim Fadiman on the show. Jim is a psychologist, writer, and lecturer who has been pioneering psychedelic research since the 1960s. He's recognized as America's wisest and most respected authority on psychedelics and their use. Jim received his bachelor and doctorate degrees from Harvard and Stanford, respectively. Apart from psychedelics, he's also been involved in researching healthy multiplicity for over 20 years. His newest book with Jordan Gruber is called Your Symphony of Selves, Discover and Understand More of Who We Are. In this episode, I talked to Jim about multiple selves. The DSM says that having multiple personalities is a disorder, but Dr. Fadiman challenges this notion. In fact, he believes that the opposite is the case. The multiplicity of selves is both normal and healthy. It's not about having one super self, but unifying the different parts of who we are. We also discuss psychedelics, its effects on mental health, and how Abraham Maslow would have viewed these mind-altering substances. It was an incredible opportunity to chat with Jim. I respect him so much, and he's one of the few living people who actually knew Abraham Maslow personally. In fact, Abe asked him to teach in his place when he went to Menlo Park during the last couple years of his life. So this was a really deeply personal episode for me, and I think you'll be inspired as well. So without further ado, I bring you Jim Fadiman.
At the moment, I'm getting a little rush. You may know Michael Pollan has a series out.
Of course, yeah.
So I'm in the first one.
Oh, Netflix.
For a couple of minutes, and maybe 2 minutes total, but I'm getting very sweet notes from people I haven't, heard from in a decade. So,
congrats.
Yeah, and everyone I know says, you look really healthy in that.
You look very healthy right now. I'm staring at you.
I am. It is, you get to a certain age and there's only one variable, which is your health. Which is, every some mornings I wake up and I think, God, I am this age. It feels like it's horrible.
How old are you now?
83, my God. And I know how that sounds because it sounds like that to me too. I hear somebody's 83, I think some old fart.
How do you feel inside? How old?
Well, it's an interesting question. I once asked my 85-year-old father and my 91-year-old uncle, Clifton Fadiman, that question. And I was, 60 or something. And my uncle said he was 7 and a half. And I said, what he said is he was learning fastest at that age.
Yeah.
And I think what he was also saying, he was starting to have an identity. And my father said he was about 20 or 21. And at that age, he left Brooklyn and spent, I think, maybe 9 months in Paris, which was like, total mind blow. And I think he was also getting more, more sensation and information per minute during that time.
Yeah.
So the answer is I'm a very healthy age. And it sometimes puzzles me that I'm in this old box.
I know. Well, you can get a lot more mileage. You're not done yet.
Well, what's nice, and as if you're each age you get older, you get more kind of extra years in the kind of statistics because the statistics, all the young people have died and so forth.
Yeah, if you make it to 90, there's a good chance you'll make it to 91.
Exactly. And you're looking good too.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. I really enjoyed your new book, and we have lots of common interests in it.
Well, you said something on Twitter the other day, and I thought that's the clearest definition of what we're trying to say that I've seen.
I know.
So you are aligning yourself with truth, but it's a distinct minority.
Yes, and I don't know if you saw the follow-up tweet. I gave people a link to your book to buy.
And also that very nice person said, I want to grow up to be Jim Fadiman.
They said that, yes. You are really cool, Jim. You really are. You've had a very long career, and you've done some really cool and interesting, fascinating things. What's it like to see this psychedelic renaissance right now? Well, I want to hear what you think of it, and then I'm curious what you think, your friend Abraham Maslow, if he was alive today, what he'd think of it.
Well, it's really a revival, okay? Remember, the Renaissance was a influx of really new information into Europe. We're like, when you get to see the Michael Pollan series, I think two out of the four start with the indigenous use. You know, so I have been called the father of microdosing, but the people who I work with, we now say of modern microdosing. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see psychedelics. Well, we are so mainstream that the New York Times crossword puzzle 2 days ago, number four down, clue, drug that can be microdosed, three letters.
Whoa.
And it's everything positive and everything, things we never thought of capitalism coming in to screw it up. And they will a lot, but as I've said for many years, mushrooms do not know they're illegal, and they also won't know when they're patented. So, yeah, no, I'm very happy to see it, and it's very wonderful. And, you know, on the microdose side of the house, the world has not yet begun to see what's possible.
I like microdosing. I prefer that. It's just more my style. Do you still microdose regularly?
Now and then. Trying a little elixir that a friend of mine made who was into Chinese medicine. And that's kind of an energy elixir. And I had noticed I haven't microdosed for a couple of months because of it. But it's ideal. It's ideal for first drafts. That's a hint.
Well, what do you think about those who want to make for pharmaceutical purposes, for healing? They want to bottle this without the hallucinogenic effects. High doses. Yeah.
Those are the same people that say, don't use Viagra. We have a new drug where you'll just have erections and orgasms, but no pleasure. Yeah, you don't have to have any, right, there's no emotional no emotional disturbances. I think it shows a kind of materialism where people literally do not have any idea of what happens during a serious psychedelic experience. And there's a term for it in psychotherapy. It's called insight.
Yeah, what?
It's not found by rattling your neurons. It's a little bit for me like the people who said, all right, guys, we have discovered the part of the brain that where dreams come from. And I say, that's terrific. Now, how do you differentiate between a sex dream and a nightmare? How do you differentiate between a wise dream that, you know? And the answer is they have the faintest idea because that's consciousness is not, you know, they don't like consciousness. They like brains.
Yeah, you're not a fan of reductionism, I take it.
I'm a fan of simplicity.
Yeah.
And simplification and parsimony, you know. I mean, it's an interesting question because microdosing, in a sense, we have a lot of the same results as the high-dose studies, you know, without any excitement. But I'm beginning to understand why and why microdosing is much more exciting to me for physical issues and for serious mental illness. That's where I find the excitement. I mean, I'll just give you my one miracle. You only get one miracle per show. Here's the miracle that I'm looking at. Woman, diabetic, 14 years, same medication, totally stable, life is fine. And for other reasons, she microdoses, and she's working with what's called a microdose coach, so she's in touch with him. And within a month, she's using 20% of her insulin dose.
Wow. Wow.
Right. See, that's wow.
How does the mind affect the body in that way?
You and I both know, because we read it, that diabetes is totally physical, it's totally your pancreas, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't have a lot of pharmaceuticals that say, take this and your pancreas will be more cheerful. Mm. Okay. But what we do have with microdosing, and let's let it go with that, it looks like it rebalances things that are in disequilibrium.
Hmm.
And it may do that by being a different level of anti-inflammatory. But I don't understand enough about some of the physical illnesses that I've got cases of to really understand it.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
Gosh, so interesting. Well, I'm just so curious about this idea of multiple cells. And right off the bat, I want you to differentiate between DSM level, multiple cells, and healthy.
Disassociation and the pathology called multiple personality.
Can you differentiate that between and what's healthy, multiple cells?
When I took my abnormal course. What I was told is the reason you're studying this is because all of these are kind of exaggerations of normal things. So that too anxious, too sad, too disorganized, so forth. And therefore, even though you're not going to be, you know, a clinician, this is helpful to understand human beings. That made sense to me. Except they said, no, multiple personalities, there isn't a healthy version.
What?
And I thought, wait. Maybe there is. And so what it is, it turns out that there is, as one would expect of any other condition, there's a healthy level of multiplicity of understanding the separations within the psyche. And there's a pathology version where they are not cooperating, where they are actually harming the whole system. So if we look upon it as family, as a family, if one member of the family is causing trouble for everyone, that doesn't mean the family has pathology. It means that part. And so there's a common senseness to looking at the question of, is there inner multiplicity? That's the first question. And if inner multiplicity is normal, then one would expect an abnormal version of it to be visible, and it is. And there are different ways of working with pathology of multiplicity, but it's much easier if you understand that it's a problem within a multiplicity, that multiplicity is not a problem. And the part of the book that I thought would of special interest to you was that early psychology, especially Charcot and Genet and Freud, all, and William James, were all quite comfortable with understanding that there was what was called disassociation, meaning a breakdown in association. And the normal of that was association. And their only argument between those groups was the clinicians, not surprisingly, said it's only found in pathology. Mm. And William James, who dealt with the real world and undergraduates, said, no, it's not. It's in everyone, because I see in everyone. That was the discussion going on until Freud really made his great shift of deciding that the sexual stories he was getting from children about parents, which we now call sexual abuse, had a serious economic problem for him, which is his clients were the children of his friends. And so he does this about face and says all that sexual memories are now, quote, fantasies. And with that went, for some reason, selves. So in a funny way, when very near the end of years and years and years of working on this, I get this realization that this is not novel. This is a return to where psychology was until Freud kind of took it off to the side. Now, Jung clearly still has internal multiplicity and so forth and so on, and lots of other people.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Jung did some microdosing.
Oh, highly likely, because every culture that we've found that has availability of mind-changing substances uses it, and small doses make obvious common sense.
Yes. By the way, you never answered what would your friend Maslow think today about, because he was a little bit skeptical. Did you ever have any personal conversations with him about LSD?
Well, he was skeptical about a lot of things. He was skeptical about almost all Eastern thought. And at one point in a new edition of Psychology of Being, he was going to put in a footnote saying, Eastern thought and tarot and all that stuff's a bunch of crap.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I read that because we were flying to the Menninger for the consciousness kind of conference. And I said, Abe, I don't think you want to do that. I think you have to realize that you may not know anything about these things, but some of us do. And wonderfully, he said, okay, I won't have that footnote.
I have the transcript of that exact conference and everything you and he said, and he mentions that exact conversation he had with you in the conference.
Oh, goody. That's right. You're this wonderful treasure trove of things that I don't know. Well, I just submitted the Maslow article to the journal, last correction, last correction, so it's pretty much what you read. And what Maslow would say is, I mean, what we saw in Maslow is a kind of optimism and excitement for what was going to happen that we no longer have. We no longer feel optimistic. And he would be in a very interesting position because he would be fascinated by psychedelics. Berger would say, you cannot possibly do this because you might change. And he would probably microdose because he would figure he could read and write better with it.
Very interesting.
The trauma, loss, and uncertainty of our world have led many of us to ask life's biggest questions, such as who are we? What is our highest purpose? And how do we not only live through, but thrive in the wake of tragedy, division, and challenges to our fundamental way of living? To help us all address these questions, process what this unique time in human history has meant for us personally and collectively, and emerge whole, I've collaborated with my colleague and dear friend, Dr. Jordan Feingold, MD, to bring you our forthcoming book. It's called Choose Growth, a workbook for transcending trauma, fear, and self-doubt. It's a workbook designed to guide you on a journey of committing to growth and the pursuit of self-actualization every day. It's chock full of research from humanistic psychology, positive psychology, developmental psychology, personality psychology, cognitive science, and neuropsychology. So lots of themes that you hear about on this podcast. And it's aimed to help us all integrate the many facets of ourselves and co-create our new normal with a renewed sense of strength, vitality, and hope. Whether you're healing from loss, adapting to the new normal, or simply looking ahead to life's next chapter, Choose Growth will help steer you there to deeper connection to your values, your life vision, and ultimately your most authentic self. Choose Growth will officially hit the shelves September 13th, and you can order your copy or the audiobook in the U.S. now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and all major retailers. If you're in the U.K. and Commonwealth, you can order now at bookshop.org.uk. We truly hope this book helps you grow and thrive and become your best self. Okay, now back to the show. You just said something a second ago. You said you submitted something in about the same form. What were you referring to, Jim?
That was the article. That was the speech he gave in 1969.
Okay, our audience isn't going to know exactly. That's like inside baseball. So, yeah.
Okay. Maslow finished his life with a fellowship from a company in Menlo Park that was in the institutional food business. But the president of that company was a absolute Maslow fan. And he said to Maslow, what would make you happy? And he said, if all I could do is read and write and create. He said, well, why don't you come out here? I will give you an office. I will give you a secretary. We all needed them then. I will give you, you know, equipment. And I will rent you a house nearby. Hmm. Well, I don't know if much of your audience doesn't know what the community around Brandeis University is, but it's not as nice as having a house with a pool in Northern California and right. being treated with such excitement and such courtesy and such grace. And he gave a talk to people at the company about where he saw humanity coming. And it was it's magnificently optimistic. And he's really seeing that we could become decent, kind, open human beings with each other. And he has a lot of evidence that he is finding. He's finding changes in the university where students are no longer just quitting if they don't like the kind of education. They're complaining. And he talks about the growth of growth centers like Esalen Institute. And when he was writing this, they were proliferating.
Yes.
And there are a lot of other examples he has. It's what I call a kind of strident optimism.
Yes.
And he and I worked on the transcript of that speech, and then I submitted it to Look magazine, which was that time there were three major magazines, Time, Life, and Look, and each had millions of subscribers. And that was there were major forces in the culture. I think he wanted me to be part of the article because I was friends with the editors we were sending it to. So that was its genesis. And then it missed their deadline or they didn't want it. And it then went into a file drawer, misfiled, until a year or so ago when a graduate student doing his dissertation had me searching for him for various things. And I found it and showed it to the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. And they're thrilled. And so it will be available soon, and it's pure Maslow at his cheerful best.
I love it. I love it. I love your connection to it. Did you ever go and visit him in his Menlo Park swimming pool house? Did you ever go swimming with him there?
No, I didn't go swimming, but he had asked me to come to Brandeis a year or so earlier, where he had a Ford Foundation grant to take a year off. And so we became friends during that year. And then when he came up to California, we were quite friendly. And one of his last projects, and it ties a little bit into what we're talking about. He said, I've really studied, you know, the best in human beings for so many years. And he said, I'm wondering now about the genesis of what he called evil. Mm. And it's the genesis of unkindness to each other. And what he said is, in looking at his grandchildren, that when there is a single child, there is no kind of evil. But as soon as there is sibling rivalry, he said, it's the first time you see people behaving in a way that's unkind to each other out of whatever those needs are. So that was one of the things he was observing, studying, thinking about in those last couple of years.
For sure. But you never visited that house, though?
I don't remember. I probably visited the house.
Because there was someone who went and did a lot of investigative work to find the precise address and to visit that house. And I have it, 855 La Mesa Drive, Portola Valley, California. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah. That's a neighborhood. Well, now insanely expensive, but then very nice houses.
Yes.
Very quiet, somewhat hilly neighborhood with a lot of views of you know, trees and grass and even more wealthy people on horses.
Yes. Well, I just sent you in an email pictures of the house, so I thought you might get a kick out of that. It's on the market right now for $5 million.
So well, I guess I said it correctly then.
Yes, you did. I can't afford it, but I was like, that'd be cool if I bought the house Maslow lived in, but I can't afford it.
If the American Psychological Association could afford it and buy it and make it a Maslow shrine, they can probably afford his house near Brandeis a lot more easily.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true. That's very true. Okay, so returning to your book a second, you say we really are different people or have different minds, parts, or personalities in different moments and in different contexts. The cells that comprise us are actual, real, independent, and innately valuable parts of who we are. So does that argue against the notion of a real self? Because I've argued against that notion, and I think we probably see eye to eye on that. There really is no such thing as the real self.
You know, if there was a real self, then there's a false self.
Right.
Or anything on that. So that's one hint. What people say is there has to be, you know, I really want it to be a single self, because I feel single. Like right now, I feel like I'm Jim Fadiman and I'm talking to my friend and it's a little warm out and I am dressed appropriately, you know, so forth and so on. But I also, when I have a small dog at the moment who is not feeling well and he's particularly attached to me. And when I pick him up and he's feeling sad, this kind of smarty, you know, vocabulary, educated, literate guy totally is not present. And I'm this little mushy person who is so sad and so linked into my little dog. It's a total set of different behaviors, and it's not a change in mood. It's a change in state. And let me make it very, very simple, which is the way people get it most easily is you say to people, have you ever argued with yourself? Okay. And everybody says, yeah. And then I say, who's the other person? And then there's a moment where people are aware that they have total memories between all those parts. That's healthy. But they behave differently. Most of us behave differently when we're with our children. We're quite different. In fact, people say, well, I can't be with you. I'm still in my work clothes. Okay, so I have to change. And I remember when I had a terrible client at one point as a consultant, just a horrible, huge, multinational, corrupt corporation. And I really felt unclean when I was working there. And it's the only time I would come home and take off all my clothes and change before kind of being with Dorothy, my wife. It was so obvious. And a lot of people, as we've learned during COVID, realized that going to work in your bathrobe didn't feel right. And a lot of people would change into their work clothes to be, as we are now, talking to each other. So we're used to making those changes. There's a wonderful term called losing your temper. The reason I like it, because it means finding your temper. And you say things that you would not say otherwise. Well, you said them. Who said them? Well, not the part of you that wouldn't say them. Okay, so there's a lot of examples. One of the ones that's most obvious is people behave differently when they're drunk.
No.
And they say, I'm so ashamed. And then in the morning, the one who didn't do it says, I'm so ashamed of how I behaved last night, when correctly is saying, I'm so ashamed when the drunk part of me behaves like that. So you also to see people and yourself, you're much more forgiving of yourself for the parts of you that the rest of you don't like.
I agree. I've noted that, like, you know, when like politicians do something corrupt or get caught for doing something corrupt, that's the key part. They'll be like, that's not who I am. that's not who anyone who knows me knows. That's really not who the real me, right. You know, it's just like, so interesting. You know, people don't seem to take responsibility for their whole self. They kind of have this authenticity bias where they, when you say who's the real you, they include the most positive aspects of themselves as the real them.
Yeah. Except people who are depressed.
Oh, that's interesting.
They identify with the worst parts or the least functional parts.
Oh, wow. That is such a good point.
Yeah. So if you're being a therapist and you realize that there's, first of all, who came to therapy? Okay. I mean, let me give you an example with a little bit of statistics. The worst known method to help alcoholics is psychotherapy. It has about a 2% success rate. And there's, like, if you look out in the literature, nobody knows, okay, except you and me are going to now know this, which is the person who drinks usually likes drinking. The person who has a hangover and is sick and wakes up guilty does not like drinking. Mm. Who do you think goes to therapy?
Yeah, you don't go to therapy drunk.
Well, the alcoholic doesn't go to therapy.
Right, right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And the wonderful part of, if you've ever been to an AA meeting, which is a really very powerful and moving positive experience, they've worked it out so the alcoholic shows up. You go in and you say, who are you? My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. That's the opening line. And then what are you there for? Well, you trade stories of your alcohol life. And you, if you're recent new, you tell this story, and it's full of justifications of why you drink, and it's not your fault. And you really don't drink that much. And, you know, sure, you had a hit and run, but hey, you know, that just happens. And then you say, and that's why I'm drinking. And then someone else in the group tells the story of their life, like five times worse than yours. So terrible, you can hardly imagine it. And they end it in saying, I've been dry for 12 years. So the alcoholic still goes to the AA meetings, dry or not. And that's why it's a fascinating and very different therapeutic milieu than any other we know.
Yeah. So that's a great point.
So who do you, you know, getting the part of you that needs helped is often difficult.
I'm so interested in the integrative functions of humans and how, you know, we still have a coherent sense of self when we walk around, or else we would be psychopathological, you know? So there are functions, executive functions and things that give us a false sense of unity sometimes.
They give us the feeling of identity.
Yes.
If you've been in a relationship with another human being for more than a few days, you expect consistency, predictability, and someone behaves and you say, how could you do that? That isn't the way, you know, you're not like that. And they say, you're right. You know, I guess I had this terrible meeting at work, and then I came home and I actually hit my kid. You know, I was beside myself. I love that. Okay, I was over here to the side. And what you realize with the person you love most in the world is they are not consistent. They are often consistent, but they have certain inconsistencies, which is another one of their selves. And once you see that, particularly when you see it in yourself, you're much more forgiving. You know, we all have a relative, for example, that is a trouble at family gatherings. Okay, don't talk politics with Uncle Albert. Uncle Albert will hit you with his theory, and he won't shut up for 20 minutes, because once the tape is running and Albert is, you know, this QAnon person, yes, he doesn't stop. Okay, now, but Uncle Albert's a nice guy most of the time. If you don't push him into selves that aren't.
Well, great point.
In order to support the Psychology Podcast, we need the help of some great advertisers. And we want to make sure those advertisers are ones you'll actually want to hear about. But we need to learn a little more about you to make that possible. So please go to podsurvey.com/the-psychology-podcast and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us to get to know you better. That way we can bring on advertisers you won't want to skip. Once you've completed the quick survey, you can enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/the-psychology-podcast. Thanks for your help. From an individual differences perspective, there seems to be gross variability among people in the extent to which they are more even keel on a regular basis versus not. At the most extremes, you have bipolar disorder, you have, you know, things that do get psychopathological. But its linkage to creativity is something that fascinates me, because I found that the creative mind is the one that seems to have more contradictions within themselves that they somehow are embrace and accept. This was the major theme of my book, Wired to Create. You know, that they accept it, that, you know, do I contain multitudes? Well, then I contain, multitudes, the Walt Whitman quote. Creative right. People have more of that attitude.
Well, they not only have that attitude, they have that awareness. And there's a wonderful quote in our book about someone who says, now and then I have a board meeting in my mind. And the person writing this, who's some famous essayist, says, I actually don't say much. I bring in the pencils and pads for people and maybe bring in coffee. But we all discuss what is an issue. And what we found is our the way we see mental health is when the parts of you are in harmony, meaning you're all working together to help each other. And the specializations support one another. So creative people seem to have a much better grasp at how to get their the right self at the right time. And if you look at there's always books about how do writers write, okay? And you find out this one's, and there's a wonderful one where he sharpens like 15 pencils before he sits down at the typewriter. Okay, that's a ritual he uses to get into the writing place. And when he leaves the writing place, in a sense, he becomes then, he can relax and be a different person. And you've written enough books to know the feeling of when you're in the writer mode and when you wish you were in the writer mode.
Yeah.
And the writer is really not the same as many other parts of you.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, it's a very interesting question and very deep question. Is it possible to create a single super self? It does feel, yeah, I'll just ask that question then and pause and see what you think.
Well, what we had to come to, my co-author and I, and Jordan Gruber did really most of the amazing scholarship in our book, is there's not much evidence for a super self. See, if you just, I was listening to somebody who was asked about, do you believe all these amazing stories about people and their psychedelic experiences? And he says, I believe in the data. So I believe in observation. And the problem with the notion of a super self is has two problems. One is it makes the rest of you, which is us 98% of the time, even if there is a quote super self, inferior. And that's not a nice feeling. And it also says, well, I don't have to make any improvements because my higher self will give me great advice. Now, it turns out that I came up with a foolproof test of higher selves. if your higher self is your best self, your most integrated self, your wisest self, then you say to someone who tells you that, you say, well, what's your highest self favorite restaurant? And after they look at me unkindly because the answer came up nothing, I then say, can you tell me any attributes of your higher self? Well, what we found is there are people, your higher self doesn't have attributes. It has like virtues. The point is that the problem for what we decided after a lot of discussion is the higher self, which also would include angelic beings who guide you, which occur in most traditions, the notion that there are spirits without bodies that help people, it's all found in indigenous people and so forth. There's a lot of things you can't cover. What we're trying to do in discussing selves is how do you function better when you're not, quote, in your higher self, which is most of the time. It's all the time. But the question, again, is how do you harmonize the parts that you have? And when we talk about personal growth, for instance, someone says, I want to lose weight. Okay? Now, here's a piece of chocolate cake. And they say, is that really good chocolate cake? And you say, it's fantastic. And they say, well, I'd like a small slice. Mm-hmm. And then they say, then another part of them says, I'd like another small slice. Mm-hmm. And part of you knows that you are just looking at the difference between 200 and 500 calories. And those two hands, one that goes back from the cake and the other that goes forward, are a beautiful view of ourselves. You know, I mean, St. Paul says, why do we do that which we would not do? And the answer is, St. Paul, I got a book for you. Because that's the question, which is, why do we do things that parts of us don't approve of? It's a very straightforward question.
The book you have for them is your book, Symphony of Selves?
Yeah. St. Paul says, hey, I'd like it. Yeah, can you? You have that in Aramaic.
You're funny. Well, it just seems like not all of ourselves are equally weighted. They're not equally prominent in our personality structure. It does feel experientially like there is a me that is more authentic, at least in the sense that there, like if I do something or there's a side of me that likes something, that there is another me that's bigger than that, that's like, you know what, I don't want to like that. There's like a higher order want.
There's selves that have a higher morality than others.
Yeah, okay. Is that what it is? Okay.
But that's the internal dialogue we have. An internal dialogue is what I'm talking about. Okay, so you have internal dialogue. You got to have two, you know, you don't have it in, you know, they're all your parts are you. They feel like, they all feel like Scott because they are. Okay, you don't feel like somebody's, you know, down the street. You say, gee, there I go.
But they don't all equally feel like Scott, I guess is my point.
Well, they do when you're in them, okay? If I'm about to do something and I know it's wrong, okay? Mm. I know it's wrong, and the part of me that wants to do it says, I know it's wrong too, but I don't care. Okay? Those parts are not equal or unequal. They're different. So you got to watch out that the parts of you that are kind of moral don't become self-righteous and prissy. Because we know that in a lot of psychopathology, a lot of psychotherapy, what people say is, I am always putting myself down. And I love that because notice how many people are in that sentence.
Yeah, it's true.
So that the language really is a good hint on what's going on. So let's go back and say, why do we have this whole notion of a single self anyway? Perhaps it's because of monotheism. See, monotheism is this very, very, it's kind of the notion there's only one divinity, except if you look at every religious system that has only one divinity, he's got a lot of friends. He's got a lot of assistants. He's got a lot of servants. There's people don't know this outside of Catholicism. There are 9 levels of angels. Now, if you're a single being, well, you have 9 levels of angels. What's going on? So monotheism, however, the notion is that there's a oneness. And therefore, you have to stuff everything in so that the composite of ourselves Again, the notion is if you're a single being, you would be consistent. Mm. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I watch it. Again, I have two little dogs. They're rescues, so they have had some childhood trauma, right? And my one littlest one, the one that is ill now, is probably, we all agree, and we've a lot of dogs in our lives, the most loving little dog we've ever met. And now and then, something happens with him, and this incredibly vicious little snarling thing with these little sharp teeth appears, and it's really scary.
Yes.
And it's real. Now, we rarely see it with each other, but his way, and it's very common pathology, how do you handle fear? We know a lot of people turn it into anger so they don't have to look at it. So he does that too. When he sees a large dog, he wants to hurt them. And some large dogs kind of look down at him and, and say, excuse me, what are you doing around my ankles? And he says, if you don't move, I'm going to wipe you out, man. So we see even in animals this differentiation, and it's fascinating when they switch, because it's as different as having a different animal.
Do you think that the more integrated a person is, in the sense that you're talking about, where all these things are in more in harmony with each other, that the person comes across as more A, comfortable in their own body, B, more cohesive, more congruent? Do you think that we can get there to a certain degree, right?
I can give you one example of someone who seems to be a single self, and then I'll start with the one that we see is unified. If you've ever listened or watched the Dalai Lama, one of the things about the Dalai Lama is he laughs at himself, okay? And it's a clue of mental health.
Yeah, I love that.
At one point, there's a film about him, and he says, you know, I fix Swiss clocks. And then he laughs, and he says, it's wonderful to be able to fix something. Okay? Now, he's perfectly aware that he's got other things, quote, more important, but that's part of him, and he's amused when that part of him, you know, needs to be dealt with. Now, a person who is totally unified, we would expect to behave absolutely the same in every situation, regardless of the externals. Mm. Okay, and we have, if one looks at the ex-president Trump, the thing that is most clear about him is he treats everything the same. Someone has a minor slight to him, like they take away his food a minute before he's finished, or we're about to have an international incident. Mm. He has the same basic responses to everything. That's what a single self actually looks like. And single self, you see, is a pathology. Unified self, diversified, harmonious self is healthy because it can act appropriately to a wide variety of situations.
Yes, but you say mental health is being in the right mind at the right time. That's your catchphrase. Don't different selves differ in what they think is the right time? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, usually, you know, I mean, for instance, during the day, you have a sales meeting with your own people. You talk to the customer you like least. You have a nice lunch with a friend. It's not from work. You go home and your children, who are small, want to play with you. These are all different aspects. And if you are in the wrong one at the wrong time, my children, one of my kids, when she was about three, I'm in a little teeny corner of our house where I don't have a desk, but I have a little table with a little portable typewriter on. And she comes in and we have some kind of interaction and she goes out. And then I hear her say to my wife, is daddy tired? Mm. Because daddy just treated her badly. And she already can tell there are different daddies. Mm. Okay, so the right mind at the right time is where there's the best match. So if you are, you know, if you're with your girlfriend, you don't treat her like you just treated your worst client. And you don't treat your worst client like he's your girlfriend. Well, you have it built in. And we actually get some very interesting training as very small children. Okay, now, I don't know if you remember this, but we were all told at some point, when you're upset, you count to 10. Mm. And as a child, you think, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. I want to just punch my little brother, and because he just hit me, and I get to hit him back. 7, 8, 9. Okay, I don't want to hit him. Okay, what happened in that spiritual practice of counting to 10 is you were able to access a more harmonious part of yourself. So we have it built in as a system, and there's dozens of ways. You know, you undoubtedly have probably taught people, you know, take a deep breath, you know, settle down, you know, relax for a moment. We have all these ways of working us into the other side. Some people say, you know, I'm going to do an interview with someone I like. I think I better have a cup of coffee first because I know that will shift my cognitive capacity a little bit that caffeine does. Okay, so I know what I'm doing, right?
I hear you. I think that for some people it's harder than others. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and the what your goal is, well, it happens at a very profound level. A few years ago when I was still traveling, I was quite physically ill a lot of the day. And I had accepted a date in Salt Lake City, and I was the event. Okay. So I really pretty much had to do it. And I crawled on the plane, and I was unhappy, and I went to the hotel, and I slept, and I'm in the green room, the little room off stage that you wait before you go on. This was the beautiful library of Salt City, and it was like 500 people. And I'm thinking, I'm so physically out of it, I wonder what happens if I faint in the middle of my talk.
Yeah.
And I said, I hope not, but I've never done that. And I went out on stage, and I had asked for a chair, not a podium. And I sat there, and I said something that made them feel welcome. And then I said a little story, and they were amused. And, you know, laughter feeds certain people's vanity, and mine is one of them. And then I did have a speech prepared. So I had some, I had notes. I don't use a PowerPoint because I change things around. And I gave really for me, a very, very good speech. And my physical capacity, when I was finished with that speech, I was physically fine. And about 2 hours later, I was back to being ill. And a graphic view of what we do, and there are ways we know physiologically, change of adrenaline and so forth, to shift. We have shifts built into the system because we need them. That's the normal, healthy behavior. And the thing that is, what the book says is, here's the really simple truth, which is you're a multiple and you can be more harmonious. And then we say, how come you don't know this? And then we say, because whenever it comes up, it kind of gets put into some little box. And then we literally, there's probably 1,000 examples from 15 different fields of human knowledge where multiplicity is described and discussed and elucidated. And what we found is the only thing I've ever written that has had this, people read it and say, oh, I'm starting to see myself and other people differently. So I wrote a self-help book, and self-help books, whatever we think of them, they're self-help. But all of them, when you're done, you have to do something. Okay? You have to lose weight, do different exercises, breathe differently, make charts and lists and do affirmations, whatever it is, whatever the book says. And I've done one of those, and people do that. But it's wonderful where you simply say to people, just notice your own mind and put it into this, try this framework. And if it feels more congruent within your prior framework, then you've just found a better way to describe your own life. And the example we use is the earth is, I don't know if this is going to frighten anyone in your group, but the earth is not the center of the universe. It's not even the center of the solar system. Watch out. But up to a certain point, it was the center of the solar system. And at that point, we had enough astronomy so we could see the orbits of the other planets. Now, imagine trying to draw the orbit of Mars around Earth. Okay, and they exist. And they're these wonderful curlicues and curves, amazing things to make it fit. And so when the sun was noticed as the center of the solar system, the astronomers were just in bliss, and science moved very, very quickly because they didn't have to create a kind of nonsense system to fit a prior belief. So when people are comfortable looking at themselves they begin to be both kinder to themselves and kinder to others. And that makes, you know, what else are we working for?
Oh, I agree. I agree. You have a section on tools, techniques, and strategies for selves work. Can you leave our listeners with some practical strategies?
I don't want to give away the book with that. I know. But we have lots of strategies. And the basic strategy is noticing. And the question is, am I in the right self now? You know, if I just yelled at my kid didn't do anything or didn't do anything very bad. Or, you know, or I am aware that I am enjoying my second cocktail. The waiter has just said, "Would you like a refill, sir?" I know that I'm good at two and I think I'm terrific at three, but nobody likes me for it. So it's noticing. And it's not blaming, because there's no judgment in that, which is, and the parts of you that say, well, the parts of you that said, no, I don't need a third because I had two cocktails before I came tonight. Okay.
Yeah.
Very normal alcoholic response is you try and work with that part. And there's lots of ways to work with that part. And the book is full of kind of tricks and methods. But the fundamental one is noticing. Once you notice, you know, none of us quite remember, but there was a point when we noticed that the other sex was worth noticing. And we had to learn a whole lot of new behavior. Okay, but we could tell the difference between who we were turned on to and who we weren't. That's also when people discover they're gay, when they're finding out who they're turned on to. And then you work, but that observation is a fundamental one. And what I've said to people, if you want to remember, because most of us can probably remember, can you remember when the idea, even just the idea of somebody else's tongue inside your mouth was so disgusting? And then a little while later you found out, well, you know, there's something to that. There's a whole other way of looking at that. So it's not about techniques as much as it is about starting with observation. And then there's lots of techniques.
Well, I'm sure that this episode has whet people's appetite more than enough to go ahead and buy your book. It is really great. I highly recommend it. It's called Your Symphony of Selves, Discover and Understand More of Who We Are. Jim, you're such a legend. I always love chatting with you, and I hope we can do this again sooner than last time.
Because it's really fun to see you again, and I'm delighted that we had this time together.
Likewise. I love you, man.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.